Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the show. Hope everybody enjoyed. Well, first of all, I hope you had the day off yesterday. And if indeed you did, I hope you enjoyed your Labor Day. I mean, if you didn't, I hope you enjoyed it too. But I just hope you got some relaxation time. Today's show is jam-packed. Didn't have the show yesterday, so got a little bit of catching up to do here. We have a letter that Obama wrote Trump, which is actually really interesting for reasons you wouldn't expect. Remember, a while back we covered George H.W. Bush's letter that he left for Clinton. This one is the one Obama left for Trump. And, yeah, I don't like it. And I'll explain why I don't like it. Then we have Donald Trump is putting his boot on the face of hardworking immigrants. This is really, really sad what's about to happen with the DACA program. We also have various heartbreaking stories, but a specific example of somebody who's here under the DACA program and how right-wing policies have ruined lives, and I mean that in a serious way. In as literal a way as possible. And then we have some stuff on NAFTA, the renegotiation of NAFTA. Hillary Clinton still won't go away. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's at the point where I think she's going to run again in 2020. I'm serious, man. I'm serious. And that makes me want to cry. That really is incredibly sad. And then Big Pharma price gouging everybody in sight. I got more stuff today than I know what to do with. So let's jump right into it. And we'll do that with the letter I was just teasing. Break out the big guns early. Here we go. The text of a letter that Obama wrote Trump has leaked. And I want to read you some of it here for reasons that I'll describe at the end. So here's the first portion of it. It's a hefty amount, but it's well worth it. So this is what Obama wrote to Trump when Trump was moving into the White House. Dear Mr. President, congratulations on a remarkable run. Millions have placed their hopes in you, and all of us, regardless of party, should hope for expanded prosperity and security during your tenure. This is a unique office without a clear blueprint for success, and I don't know that any advice from me will be particularly helpful. Still, let me offer a few reflections from the past 8 years. First, we've both been blessed in different ways with great good fortune. Not everyone is so lucky. It's up to us to do everything we can to build more ladders of success for every child and family that's willing to work hard. Second, American leadership in this world is indispensable. So it's up to us through action and example to sustain the international order that's expanded steadily since the end of the Cold War and upon which our own wealth and safety depend. Third, we are just temporary occupants of this office. That makes us guardians of those democratic institutions and traditions like rule of law, separation of powers, equal protection, and civil liberties that our forebears fought and bled for. Regardless of the push and pull of daily politics, it's up to us to leave those instruments of our democracy at least as strong as we found them. Okay, so here's why this letter pisses me off. As if you didn't know that was coming. The first thing that he throws out there is, well, look, we're both personally blessed, and we should acknowledge that. Not everybody's as lucky as us, and we got to try to help out those who are less fortunate and build more ladders for hardworking people to make it. Okay, that's fine. No problem with that. But the second point he made, if you want to interpret it in a very straightforward way, it's continue the empire. Because this is what he says. American leadership in this world really is indispensable. You want to ask the people of Vietnam that question? You want to ask the people of Iraq or Afghanistan or any of the other countries that we've militarily intervened in post-World War II? I mean, the second fucking point he makes is American leadership is indispensable. It's up to us through action and example to sustain the international order that's expanded steadily since the end of the Cold War and upon which our own wealth and safety depend. That's interesting. Upon which our own wealth and safety depend. So that's an admission that, hey, it's because of our militaristic foreign policy that we can stay in control of the world's natural resources, and our own wealth depends on staying in control of those natural resources. That's a very clear admission right there. So what one should take away from this portion of the letter that Obama left for Trump is that Obama, in his heart of hearts, believes in so-called American exceptionalism, believes in the idea that we're not a nation among nations, we're a nation above nations, which is an American supremacist ideology, which is essentially a neocon philosophy. Now, when he ran in 2008 and even in 2012, he wasn't portraying himself that way. No, he was portraying himself in the opposite way. He was saying we should get out of these wars. But then when he governed, when he was actually president, what did he do? He took two wars that Bush left us and turned them into seven interventions. So if he wanted to get us out, well, mission failure, because he got us involved in more interventions. Now, you know, the way that many in the media would portray that and spin that is, well, I mean, what are you going to do? He was inherited this mess, and then he had to react, and it was all because of Bush's mistakes that President Obama just bungled his way into another six more interventions. Well, that's ridiculous, and now we know his thought process. He's saying right here, American leadership in this world really is indispensable. And it is the international order that's expanded steadily since the end of the Cold War upon which our wealth and safety depend. So all the talk, anytime he ever said, hey, we're creating more terrorists with this war on terror, he was just mimicking the mouth noises that he knew people on the left wanted to hear to get him in power, and then once he got in power, what did he do? The same old shit. So you can put to bed whatever, you know, question still remained. This gets rid of all the illusions. The second fucking point he makes to Trump is continue the empire. And this gets back, what's funny is that was an argument that Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz and other cretins on the right made against Trump in the primary. When Trump used to say, hey, what are we doing? We got to get out of Iraq. We got to get out of Afghanistan. We got to rebuild here at home. We're wasting all this money overseas for no reason. There's no end in sight. It's useless. It's never going to improve the situation. All the people on the right would say, oh, how dare you suggest those things? I mean, don't you understand? America's the indispensable nation. And we need to be in control of our own wealth and taxes. And guess what? Everybody else got obliterated in that primary. So people on the right openly argue the establishment neocon narrative, and it got incredibly crushed, smashed, defeated, routed. And so now we learn Obama behind closed doors, same shit. Well, we got to keep it going. We got to keep the American Empire going. Okay, so what? We have 900 military bases around the world. It costs $100 billion a year to maintain. Meanwhile, we don't even have clean water in Flint, Michigan, and elsewhere across the country. Our infrastructure gets a grade of D+. What are you going to do? Got to continue the empire. The second fucking point he makes. The first one is just a bullshit personal point. Oh, you're lucky, I'm lucky, so we got to try to help out other people vaguely, kind of, not really. But American leadership, indispensable in the world, which is why, by the way, polls of regular people around the world show that when you ask them which country is the biggest threat to world peace, America wins by a mile and a half. So it's indispensable, even though everybody hates it, we create more terrorists, and we have nothing to show for the war on terror except more terrorists being created and wasting our money, wasting our lives, our resources. And then the final point I want to make on this is, he talks about, oh, we have to uphold our institutions. We're temporary occupants, so we're guardians of democratic institutions and traditions, rule of law, separation of powers, equal protection, civil liberties. Dude, you don't get to rant about those things and talk about those things in the way you are here while, for example, it was you and your administration that had fucking kill lists. Deeply unconstitutional. You killed Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, a 16-year-old boy. An American boy, no due process, there was no trial, no nothing. You killed him with a fucking drone and he was on your kill list. And then you're going to rant about rule of law and separation of powers and equal protection and civil liberties. Does he get to do that while Edward Snowden is in hiding when Snowden was exposing unconstitutional actions of our own government? That's a war on whistleblowers. Now, thankfully, at the end, he did the right thing with Manning, but not with Snowden. So again, he's ranting about rule of law, separation of powers. You know, just so everybody knows, it's supposed to be the case under our Constitution that presidents get approval when they do a war. Congress has to approve war. Obama didn't go through Congress for his eight interventions. I lose count. That's how many there fucking been. So, I mean, think about that. He's ranting about these high-minded principles of government that we have set up in this country. Meanwhile, he skirted them whenever he thought it was necessary. So he went right around Congress and said, no, we're going to – all these extra interventions that we're doing, which are illegal under international law and unconstitutional under our own system, I'm just going to say we're adding that to – the authorization for the use of military force that came under Bush for the war on terror. So he doesn't realize, in many ways, he laid the groundwork for a guy like Trump. And what's always been incoherent is the two arguments that come from corporate Democrats against Trump. One of them being, he's an unhinged lunatic, and you cannot trust him with that nuclear red button. That's one argument. I think that argument is correct. And then the second argument is, and why isn't he being more hawkish and upholding the empire more? You can't have it both ways. You got to pick one or the other. It's either, oh my God, he's a crazy person. I can't believe he has a nuclear red button. It's either that, or it's, man, he should be more interventionist and more hawkish and uphold the empire more. And oh my God, why isn't he escalating more with Vladimir Putin and do more sanctions on him and push further to the brink of war with him? You can't have it both ways, man, but the Democrats do because they're incoherent and they have no core philosophy. So what a sad, sad letter this is. The second fucking point is continue the empire. Oh, man. We need a radical realignment of our priorities and a total retooling of our system. We need to spend our own tax money on things that make sense, like universal health care, and universal education, and a living wage, and an infrastructure deal, and ending the drug war and putting that money into rehab and education. There's so many things we could do here at home, and we don't fucking do it. Because whether it's Democrats or Republicans, you get the same old garbage, and this letter is another example of it. Okay. Next. I'm drinking out of a very vague styrofoam cup today. This thing is totally ambiguous. You have no clue what's in this cup. This could be beer, this could be wine, this could be hard liquor, this could be high C, this could be water, this could be, stay with me, seltzer. Am I now a sellout to big styrofoam? Think about it. Okay. I got a video of Trump here, and we're going to dive into the immigration stuff. CNN's Andrew Kaczynski dug up an old video of Trump on Fox and Friends. He's discussing immigration. The backstory here is you had Newt Gingrich and Michelle Bachmann in a presidential debate at the time, so I guess this was back in 08. It's probably 07, 08, I guess. And you had Michelle Bachmann, who I think back then was on the page of just deport everybody. Deport all undocumented immigrants. I don't give a fuck about their age, yada, yada. And Newt Gingrich, of all people, was like, no, that's stupid. Don't do that. That goes way too far. And, of course, the scandal in conservative circles was that Newt Gingrich was not in favor of deporting every single undocumented immigrant. So they asked Trump his opinion on this, and his take may surprise you. Let's watch.
You asked Michelle to actually physically go across the street and tell the family of 25 years to get out of this country, she wouldn't do it because she's a good person.
But here's the problem with Mitt Romney in this situation. He came out and say it's a magnet and he disagrees. But in 2007, he was calling for the same exact thing. Newt Gingrich fired back and said, here's your clip from Meet the Press from 2 years, 3 years ago. Does that bother you?
Well, actually, he didn't strongly disagree. And in fact, a lot of people are really curious as to when he'll say something because, you know, from I just saw something on television where they were saying that he really hasn't taken a stance or a very strong stance yet, and he hasn't said anything about what Newt said. So let's see what he says. But look, this is a matter of this isn't conservative. I'm the world's most conservative person. This isn't conservative. This is compassion.
Is it amnesty?
I guess to a certain extent, for a very limited number of people, it would be considered amnesty. But how do you tell a family that's been here for 25 years to get out?
That's tough. Or if their kids are born here, they stay, the parents leave, and that's what
right.
Newt Gingrich's contention
right.
is. How can you be the party that is pro-family and dividing the family, but the...
Damn. Now, wouldn't it be lovely if Donald Trump took Donald Trump's advice? Because now we got the news this week that he's going to end DACA. DACA, of course, is the program where children who are the children of undocumented immigrants who came to this country when they were young, under the age of 16. And by the way, the overwhelming majority of them are way younger than that. They come when they're toddlers. That program basically pushes off any kind of deportation. And says, okay, well, you came here through no fault of your own, undocumented parents, you were a little kid, and then your whole life is here, you know nothing else. They're ending that program. And what they're going to do is they're ending it, I think it's in 6 months, and they're passing the buck, really. So what they're doing is they're saying to Congress, okay, now you need to come up with some sort of a solution, and... we're going to try to end DACA while washing our hands of all responsibility. So, hey, if you don't come up with something, it is what it is, and what are we going to do? 800,000 to a million people are going to have their lives uprooted and destroyed. But, hey, this is why it's on Congress now. You guys got to come up with some sort of a solution. So that's what they're trying to do. And Trump is such a fucking pussy that he's not making the announcement himself. He's having Jeff Sessions make the announcement. He's telling Jeff, you go do it, because he knows it's going to get negative press, because the preliminary reactions have been, what the, are you kidding me? So think about how many lives are going to be negatively affected. It is exactly what he was ranting against there.
We said, oh, what are you going to do? People, 25 years, been here, the family, 25 years. How are you going to tell them to leave? This isn't, I'm the most conservative person there is. This is compassion. That's what this is. This isn't conservative, it's compassion.
Well, what happened? Now you're going to absolutely obliterate the lives of these children who came into the country. They didn't choose it. They were brought here when they were kids. They've set up lives here. This is all they know. And now you're saying, yeah, I don't give a fuck. I'm going to end DACA. That's beyond fucked up, man. By the way, because now we all know, hey, what's the next argument that comes from the far right on this?
Well, it's been documented, immigrants, criminals. Yeah, criminals. They're criminals.
What percentage of people under the DACA program are criminals? Less than 1%. What's the next argument, the far right?
Well, you've got the leeches, moochers off the system.
Yeah, that's what it is. You know, like that. Moochers. They just take all the government money and they don't do anything. They're not hard working. Percentage of people under the DACA program are employed? Over 90%. So every garbage argument that can be thrown at this is just not true. The reality is, these are hard-working people. These are good people. They were brought here through no fault of their own, and now you're going to punish them for the sins of their parents. But honestly, we shouldn't even really be that surprised. Sure, Trump contradicts himself now, because back in the day he was more reasonable on this, but he contradicts himself on fucking everything. And furthermore, this is what he said about drone strikes.
We have to take out their families. We have to take out their families.
So not just ISIS, the family members of ISIS. So punish people who are related, maybe, maybe not, because whatever, guilty enough. That's how he thinks. When he's thinking of brown people, that's how he thinks. So this is absolutely pathetic. Their position is untenable, man. The hardliner immigration people, like, I get it, everybody gets it. You want to deport people who are criminals? Sure, whatever, that's fine. But outside of that, we're a goddamn nation of immigrants. Do you not understand that? It's so funny when you see like somebody of European descent ranting against immigration. Like, bitch, you're an immigrant. Do you not get that? There were Native Americans here. And if you're what? You're in favor of a hardline immigration stance? Okay, so shouldn't you be ranting against people of European descent then? Because we all came here at some point and we were fucking immigrants. No, it's always just super historically convenient where they draw the line and where they say, now we got to be hardline on immigration. So in other words, whatever is beneficial to you and only you. So, and you're not going to be objective about this. You're not going to come up with standards that make actual sense. It's just, oh, whatever is most convenient for me. So I'm hardline on immigration, but only starting at this date when it's European people, and then we can be assholes to everybody else. You're not smart. You're not intellectual, you're not witty, you're not clever, you're just deeply bigoted, and policies like this prove it. Okay. All right, let's see. Do we have time here for one more before the break? No, let's not do... Let's take the break now, and then when we come back, I got one more on immigration for you that's really, really heartbreaking. And again, it's going to show you how this DACA move is just totally heartless and dumb. And then we'll get into Trump's gifts from Saudi Arabia and the NAFTA renegotiation and Hillary Clinton still won't fucking go away. Oh! So buckle up, son. We're just getting started. We got a jam-packed show today. And we will be right back.
What you know about that? I know all of
Continue here with immigration stories. I got one more here that just I teared up as I read about it, because this is the current state of affairs here in the country. Law News has a heartbreaking story for us that highlights what Republican policies have done to innocent and unsuspecting families. Listen to this. Alonzo Gulen was a 31-year-old DJ from Lufkin, Texas. He died attempting to rescue people during Hurricane Harvey when his boat capsized after slamming into an access road bridge on Interstate 45. He went missing last Wednesday, and his body was finally discovered by watchful family members as it was seen floating down Cypress Creek in Spring, Texas on Sunday. Guyan, I don't know how to pronounce that, I'm sorry, was also enrolled in the Federal Immigration Program, officially known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, recipients of which are commonly referred to as DREAMers. The DACA program allows for undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States before the age of 16 to temporarily avoid deportation and requires beneficiaries to avoid committing crimes or engaging in gang-related activity. To date, roughly 1,500 DACA recipients have been deported for such reasons, or less than 1% of all DREAMers. Gulen was born in Piedras Negras, Mexico, and came to Lufkin as a minor, and now his mother wants to be there for the funeral. But she can't. While Gulen's father is a legal permanent resident of the United States, his mother, Rita Ruiz de Gulen, is currently applying for legal status here and unable to cross the border in order to bury her son. She had hoped U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials would be understanding of the situation and issue a humanitarian visa so she could properly mourn, but her request was denied, and the grieving 62-year-old was sent back to Mexico after reaching the U.S. border. That's sick, man. That's sick. So you have a DREAMer who's out there being a hero, saving lives during a hurricane. I mean, you want to talk about being as American can be. That's as American as it gets right there. Let me go save people during a hurricane. Look out for my fellow Americans. He was here under the DACA program, the program that Trump is ending, even though less than 1% of people in the program are criminals, and over 90% are employed. So these are people who came here who had parents that were undocumented immigrants, and they've been here since they were kids, so they know nothing else. Trump's ending this program. This is an example of somebody in the program who was a hero, and the system is so immensely disrespectful that they're not even allowing his mother in for her son's funeral. Even if you're somebody who's super far right on the spectrum, you have to see how that's fucked up. You have to see that. Because just imagine it's some, you or some family you know or somebody you're close to in a situation like this happens. I mean, that would drive you fucking crazy, right? You would think that that's the most tyrannical, unreasonable, cold-hearted government ever. Man. Stories like this, they make my blood boil. There was the other one. Remember we covered recently? Veterans who were deported? I didn't even know that was possible. So you have, I guess, people who were immigrants here, and then they fought for the military in the hopes that, hey, maybe this will let people know that I'm just as American as the next person, and I'm choosing to be here because I think this is a great country and all that. And then they get deported? Oh, that's as dark as it gets, man. That's just sickening. And this is where we are. And just as we covered in the previous segment, Trump's so much of a bitch. He's such a coward. He's sending his little bitch boy out there, his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, to do all the dirty work and announce it. Because it's been getting bad press when there were leaks that, hey, he's going to end DACA. So he doesn't want the bad press. He's sending out Jeff Sessions. And what they're going to do is give Congress 6 months to try to come up with a different, solution. And whatever that solution is, naturally, it's going to be tougher on people like this. When, again, I don't get it. So what reason is there to do a policy like this, when less than 1% of people under the DACA program are criminals, in which case if they are criminals, they get deported, less than 1% are criminals and over 90% are employed. And many of them are people like this, heroes who are just as American as can be. So what reasoning is there to be against people like this? Let me think about that one. You know the answer to that. So don't get mad when people on the left rightly call you bigoted when you favor bigoted policies. It's a pretty simple concept. And if you have any bare minimum level of basic human decency, you can look at a story like this and go, wow, that's really fucked up now, isn't it? Okay. Now, let's go to how much of a sellout Trump is. Journalist Ken Klippenstein has a report out in the Daily Beast about Donald Trump's recent trip to Saudi Arabia. And it reads like a bad comedy movie. So look at this. During the presidential campaign, Donald Trump attacked Hillary Clinton for accepting money from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, complaining during one of the debates, "These are people that kill women and treat women horribly, and yet you take their money." That was, of course, before he made his first visit as president to Saudi Arabia and accepted dozens of gifts from the kingdom. In fact, during Trump's visit, the White House accepted at least 83 separate gifts from Saudi Arabia, according to a document the Daily Beast has obtained via a Freedom of Information Act request to the State Department. The gifts range from the regal artwork featuring picture of President Trump to the marshal, multiple swords, daggers, leather ammo holders and holsters, and the Baroque, tiger and cheetah fur robes, and a dagger made of pure silver with a mother-of-pearl sheath. Now when the president is contemplating the state of Saudi women's rights, he can do so before a large canvas artwork depicting a Saudi woman. So I went through the list, and by the way, you can check it out. I'll leave the link in the video description box to the original piece, and you can read through the different things he got. It's ridiculous. It's like a bad comedy movie. I mean, they give leather sandals. You have some of the funnier examples here. Artwork of himself. They're giving him a painting of himself. Oh, come on. A pure silver dagger. Tiger and cheetah fur robes. I mean, this is like, you couldn't have a Hollywood director write it better. As ridiculous as the list is and as funny as it is, think about what's happening here. Why are they doing that? Why are they? And who knows what the total sum in gifts that they're giving him is. Like, how much money is all this stuff worth? I'm guessing it's worth a lot of fucking money overall. So why are they doing that? Why are they giving him gifts? Well, the answer is easy. They're trying to curry favor. I mean, you had a deal. Remember, a deal was announced between the United States and Saudi Arabia that were arming them to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars as they massacre women, children, civilians in Yemen. And they're blockading the country. So there's a fucking cholera outbreak. They don't have basic medicine. Little kids are starving. That's literal. So they're absolutely destroying a country. They're obliterating a country. And we're arming them to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars as they bomb open-air markets and mosques and hospitals and schools for the blind. And we're doing all that and taking gifts. And that's to say nothing of the domestic situation in Saudi Arabia, which Ken Klippenstein alluded to here. I mean, look, we're talking about a country that treats women as second-class citizens. They make the women cover up from head to toe. They need a guardian to go somewhere. They're not allowed to drive. They say all atheists are terrorists in Saudi Arabia. This is a tyrannical, theocratic, far-right, absolute monarchy and dictatorship. And then we're going to pretend like we care about freedom and liberty and democracy and human rights as we prop up the probably the worst offending regime on the planet that's against all those things. Why? Because they're our business partner, and look at this. Oh, you give them some gifts, and the Americans do whatever you want. They're corrupt. That's what's happening here. And where on God's green earth are the 8,000 articles talking about Donald Trump being a puppet of the Saudi regime? Imagine for just a second, the facts were he took 83 gifts like this from Russia. Every fucking publication under the sun would say, oh my God, see, this is the proof that we need. This is the smoking gun. Donald Trump is a puppet of the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin. And guess what? In that instance, they would be correct if these were the facts in the Russia situation. Of course, it's not the facts in the Russia situation, but you will see more articles today about how Trump is a puppet of Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin than you will see articles that Trump is a puppet of Saudi Arabia, when we know they gave 83 ridiculous gifts to him. And he gave them, over a $300 billion deal in weapons and money? So we can just fork over gobs and gobs of cash to them and money to them. Well, cash and money, same thing. Wow, that was weird. We can gob over weapons to them all day long. They can do whatever they want with it. And they give our politicians gifts. By the way, it's not just Trump they gave gifts to. They probably gave it to all the people who were with him on when he went on the trip there. But nobody says in the mainstream media, hey, looks like this is not ethical or moral. It looks like this might be corruption. It looks like they may be trying to buy favors. It looks like Trump may be a puppet of Saudi Arabia. And shock, shock, every fucking foreign policy decision he's made that affects that region, it's on the side of Saudi Arabia. And this is a guy who used to say, before he was president, Saudi Arabia is, you know, the largest funder of terrorism. Saudi Arabia was partly responsible for funding the people who did 9/11. And he was right. But now that he's president, oh, fuck all that. Corruption all day long, baby. Gimme, gimme, gimme. You give me gifts, I give you favors. But not a single idiot in the establishment media will say, oh, this is him being a puppet of Saudi Arabia. But he's a puppet of Russia, even though he's not taking 83 gifts from them, but Saudi Arabia. Notice how whenever it's an ally of ours, they get a full pass. They can do whatever the fuck they want. So if the U.S. gives hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons to Israel, and Israel showers our guys with gifts and money and all that shit, it doesn't count. It doesn't count that we turned a blind eye to their apartheid and their occupation and their destruction of Gaza. It doesn't count. No politician in the U.S. is a puppet of the Israeli government. It's not possible, even when they are. It's not possible. And it's not possible that a U.S. politician is a puppet of Saudi Arabia, even though they are. But Russia, with no evidence, oh, they're a puppet of Russia. It's fucking frustrating, man. It is really fucking frustrating. And I've pointed out a million examples of this. Did you know Donald Trump registered businesses in Saudi Arabia when he was running for president on the campaign trail? He registered 8 or 12 or something like that new businesses in Saudi Arabia. And not a single person said, hey, maybe there's a conflict of interest here. Nobody said it. Not a single fucking person said it. But again, Russia with less evidence, oh my God, puppet of Russia. Puppet of fucking Saudi Arabia all day long. Ken Klippenstein did a great job through the Freedom of Information Act, released 83 fucking gifts that they received, and nobody says it. This system is broken. And the media is fucking broken, and it's the saddest thing ever. Okay. Okay. Now, let's go to the NAFTA story. The Globe and Mail has an amazing story about the NAFTA renegotiation going on right now. Canadian negotiators are demanding the United States roll back so-called right-to-work laws. Accused of gutting unions in some U.S. states, by starving them of money as part of the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The request is part of a push by Ottawa to get the U.S. and Mexico to adopt higher labor standards under the deal. Mexico, meanwhile, is campaigning to include its oil and gas sector in the deal. These major moves on the labor and energy files came over the weekend at the second round of NAFTA renegotiations in Mexico. One group of negotiators spent all day Sunday working on the labor file, according to a schedule of the talks obtained by the Globe and Mail. One source familiar with the discussions said Canada wants the United States to pass a federal law stopping state governments from enacting right-to-work legislation. The source said the United States has not agreed to such a request. Canada believes that lower labor standards in the United States and Mexico, including right-to-work, give those countries an unfair advantage in attracting jobs. Okay, so we've discussed the NAFTA renegotiation a little bit previously, and the reason why we did is because Donald Trump and his team are sliding in different proposals and provisions of the TPP into the NAFTA renegotiation. Think about how cynical a move that is. Now, at least with the other Republicans, they were upfront about their shitty beliefs. They were like, yes, we're in favor of TPP. We're in favor of outsourcing more jobs. You know, effectively, fuck the American worker. They were much more upfront in their embracing of so-called free trade deals, but they're really outsourcing deals. Now, that was a horrible strategy because people go, oh, I don't want to lose my job, so we're not going to vote for you, Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush or Ted Cruz, and they voted for Trump because Trump was strongly anti-trade in his rhetoric on the campaign trail. But see, Trump is also a giant liar. So he gets into office, and what does he do? He kills TPP with an executive order, which everybody gave him credit for, as they should have, but when nobody's looking, during the renegotiation of NAFTA, you slip in those same disastrous provisions of TPP. And it's the worst provisions of TPP that he's resurrected to slip into the NAFTA renegotiation. Now, my guess was that after he killed TPP, what he would do is bring back TPP and call it the Trump trade deal or something ridiculous and say it's the most tremendous deal ever, it's the best deal ever, the most unbelievable, believe me. And then he'd try to pass it. But no, he was actually more sly, more slick. He said, I'm not going to bring it back in as a separate trade deal. I'm just going to quietly slip provisions in there. Only a handful of media outlets will report on it, and everybody might still think, oh, he's anti-trade. That's not true. So that's why we discussed the NAFTA renegotiation beforehand. Today, we're discussing it because the policies that the Canadian government is pushing for are more pro-American worker than the policies the American government is pushing for. Think about that. Let it swirl around in your head and marinate in your brain. That's incredible. The things that the Canadian government is pushing for are things that would help the U.S. worker more than what the American government is pushing for. Now, they're not doing it because they're kind. They're not doing it because they're good people. And, oh, they're just looking out for the American worker. No. The reasoning was given to you at the end there. Canada has higher labor standards. They have stronger unions. They have better rules. They have better regulations. And as a result of that, you're going to have corporations, they don't want to go there. The owner class, the elite, the establishment, they want to go where there are as few regulations and rules and strong labor unions as possible. So that's why they're more likely to, you know, ship all the jobs out to Mexico. And when we talk about NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, under other trade deals, they love shipping jobs to fucking Bangladesh and places where there are virtually no rules and regulations. Because that's better for the owner class. That's the only group of people it's good for. Sucks for the fucking workers across the board. It's a race to the bottom in terms of wages and benefits and whatnot. But it's only good for the elite, so they, oh, ship it to Bangladesh, ship it where, you know, we can exploit damn near slave labor. So Canada, because they have better rules and regulations and stronger unions, they're like, look, we want to make it so that we're on an even playing field here. So you need to treat your workers better so that the ownership class doesn't want to send all the jobs to Mexico, and honestly, what they're saying is to the U.S. too. Isn't that crazy? We're now in the same conversation as Mexico in terms of how we treat our workers. There was a time when the U.S. had strong unions, but there's been a war on unions from Reagan and onward, and they chipped away. year by year, chipped away. Union membership is at an all-time low, and shock, shock, the middle class is hurting more than it's ever been. Because there's a direct correlation between how strong your unions are and how healthy your middle class is. So now Canada is saying, you guys got to stop with these right-to-work laws. You know what that is? That's where they say, oh, you know, there's not the union membership dues. So in other words, you can have people who are not union, but they still benefit from all the work that the union has done. And these are, so in other words, you don't have to fund the union, but you could still reap all the benefits of the union. Well, guess what? Over time, if nobody funds the union goes away. So it's a backdoor attempt to crush the unions. And it's the reason why it's so dangerous is that it's phrased in a way where people think it's about freedom, my freedom to from the tyranny of more vacation time and better wages. That's what I need, freedom from that tyranny. So people take their union for granted, say, I'm not going to pay the union dues, but then they still get the benefits of the union until the union's no more, and then all of a sudden the wages go down, the vacation time goes down, and they go, fuck, we should have funded the union when we could have. So right-to-work laws are really right-to-work for less, because they've done there's been a bunch of different analyses of this, and they found that in the states that are right-to-work states, the pay on average is like $1,500 less per year, nothing to scoff at, and they get worse health care, worse benefits, not as much paid vacation time, so on and so forth. So right-to-work is really right-to-work for less. And Canada's saying, well, that makes it so the ownership class wants to set up shop there. No, let's have good labor standards everywhere and then make it an even playing field in terms of where the jobs go. So, yeah, we should get rid of the right-to-work laws. Look, you don't have to – the libertarians would say, well, you've got to make the conditions most appealing to the corporations for the corporations to stay there. But the problem with that reasoning is the best-case scenario for a corporation is always pay the least amount possible to the workers. So in all seriousness, wage slavery is preferable to the corporations. They want to pay people less than a living wage. They do, because that means more profit, more money for their shareholders, more money for the bottom line. So since that's the case, you can't just have them run the show. You have to have rules and regulations to prevent the abuses of that system, to stop that system from running amok. And unfortunately in the U.S., we've said, no, let's go more in the direction of what the corporations want. But no, if you have organized labor, they can be a counterbalance, a counteracting force to the greed and recklessness of the corporations, to the amoral machine that is the corporation. So organized labor fights for a standard work week with a decent amount of hours, paid vacation time, maternity leave, a living wage, no child labor, stuff like that. And Labor Day was yesterday, and this is a good time to thank a union for all the things that they've given us that many people don't even know how hard people had to fight to get these basic things, just like a weekend, for example. So Canada's right. Let's end these bullshit right-to-work laws. Let's pay people more, give them better vacation time, and make the corporations be reasonable. They're not going to do it because they're kind, because they're not. So you have to make them be reasonable with rules and regulations, and we should have an even playing field where we respect labor across borders. Okay. Okay, let's take our final break, and then when we come back, oh man, article from The Hill is a great example of an establishment bias against Bernie Sanders. I will explain that in depth. And then we have Hillary Clinton will not go away. Big Pharma is continuing to screw us over. I can't, man. We got a whole bunch of incredible stories when we get back from the break. So don't go anywhere. You're crazy if you missed the last segment. All right, we'll be right back. I think a lot of you were probably waiting for this next story, and I don't blame you. Hillary Clinton still won't go away. She's refusing. She keeps showing up. You know, Mitt Romney went away more than Hillary Clinton's gone away. And that's sad, because it's not like Mitt Romney totally went away. He didn't. So she endorsed a new media platform called Verit. She said, "I'm excited to sign up for Verit, a media platform for the 65.8 million. Will you join me and sign up too?" So, you know, you might be thinking, what does that mean, a platform for the 65.8 million? You know what that is? That's her total number of popular votes. So she's... You would think that they would be smart enough to not be insular after their election loss, but they just got more insular. So they're saying, "Oh, this is a media platform for Hillary Clinton voters." Yeah, you know, Wonderful. So you want to, what, run again and get the same voters the next election and still lose? Hey, look, we won the popular vote again but lost the election. That's not, like, that's not something to be proud of. It's not like, oh, if I won the popular vote, I won the popular vote. Yeah, we get it. You won the popular vote. But how do you win the Electoral College as well, not just the popular vote? But no, they've now created a media platform where they say, all right, Hillary Clinton and our supporters, let's go in that bubble together and spew vacuous talking points at each other and make ourselves feel good emotionally. Doesn't Bernie Sanders suck? Yeah, Bernie Sanders sucks. Don't you blame him for the election loss? Yeah, I blame him for the election loss. Isn't Donald Trump the worst? Yeah, Donald Trump's the worst. And by the way, I'm not kidding. Verrett tweeted an article or, you know, something on their own site about how Bernie Sanders is to blame for Donald Trump winning. It's like they're trying to lose again, man. And by the way, this is a good indicator that Hillary Clinton is going to run again in 2020. I'm not kidding. She refuses to go away. She wants to launch a political action committee that's funneling more Wall Street money to corporate Democrats. She's still trying to be involved in the resistance. Now she's promoting a social media platform that's a brand new platform where the whole point of it is to fight misinformation and to get away from the goddamn Bernie bros and the Trump supporters. And it's for the 65.8 million who voted for her. And it's that insular Hillary Clinton bubble where they're trying to protect people from the outside world. What's so funny is what they're actually doing is the opposite of what they claim. Because they claim, like, oh, this is for facts. We're trying to get facts out there and, like, information and stuff. And, yeah, so anyway, let's go in our bubble with our 65.8 million people who voted for Hillary and say things that we all agree with. So, how do I know that this is an insular media platform that's actually not interested in facts and that they're just trying to push a pro-Hillary Clinton and pro-corporate Democrat narrative? You know who created it? Peter Dow. Peter Dow. You know who Peter Dow is? Peter Dow was directly involved in running the John Kerry campaign in 2004, which lost to George W. Bush after he had already been elected in office for 4 years. And he couldn't, with Peter Dow's help, John Kerry couldn't win. That's the saddest thing ever. You know what else happened? Hillary Clinton, overwhelming favorite, 2008, lost to Barack Obama. Peter Dow was directly involved in her campaign. So Peter Dow is a loser. I'm not saying that as a personal insult. I'm saying it as a factual description of reality. He lost repeatedly, worked for failed corporate Democrat campaigns. But now he thinks he has the solution to how Democrats can win elections when it's been proven over and over. They lose when they do shit that Peter Dow wants them to do. So look at this. Peter Dow tweets, thread, exciting news. Hillary Clinton endorses Verrett, the media platform we're building for the 65.8 million. Hillary Clinton endorsed Verrett, our new media platform, an hour ago, and we've already been subject to a denial of service attack. They launched this thing. They think it's going to be huge. They think people are going to love it. First of all, I've never seen a stronger, you know, across-the-board reaction to a social media site than I saw on Twitter in their reaction to Verrett. Everybody just, at the same time, started shitting on it. Because it's such a stupid idea. It's just such a bad idea. And they launch a thing that's going to be great. Immediate DDoS attack. Oh, Peter, you're so sad. You're so sad. Now, if you want to know a little bit more about how it works, okay, see, this is how you know it's a bad idea. It's not immediately obvious how it works. So from everything I've read about it, you have, it's almost like e-cards. Remember how e-cards work? You have, like, you put something into Verrett that's like a fact or a piece of information. And then you get a verification code. And then that's it. So you have to put facts in there. There's a verification code for the fact. And then people could see it as like an e-card or something. And then, of course, you idiot Peter Dow, people saw it. And they're computer programmers who can make fake, you know, verified Verrett cards. So it looks exactly like it's from Verrett, but it's not from Verrett. because the coding for it was apparently super simple for other people to do. And then they put stuff like, Bernie would have won, Peter Dow, a quote from Peter Dow. So they do quotes from people and little facts about shit, and it's like, this is going to blow up in an epic way, in a historic way. And a good point that people have been making is, people might think, why the fuck is Hillary Clinton aligning herself with this guy who is just, like, he's really just a clown on the internet. He's universally derided and mocked. He's like the biggest joke. He blocked me a long time ago because I pointed out how he said shit that made no fucking sense. But here's the answer. Hillary Clinton's aligning herself with this loser because Peter Dow expresses the exact kind of narrative about what happened in 2016 that Hillary Clinton agrees with. And that's a really scary thing because Peter Dow basically blames Bernie Sanders and the so-called Bernie bros for Hillary Clinton's election loss. So in other words, it's all the left. Do left punching all day long. Blame the populist left. Blame the people who really want Medicare for all, who really want free college, who want a living wage, who want to end the wars, who want to end the drug war. Blame the people who dare to want a better future for the failures of the left. You're supposed to just fall in line for the Democratic Party. Don't you understand that? I think she might run again in 2020, man. And she hopes Verrett becomes the Breitbart of the left. This is something that David Brock spoke about after the election loss. We want to create a Breitbart of the left. Well, that's a weird thing to say because, you know, Breitbart's like, they're liars. they fucking say horrendous shit. We want to do that for the left, so do your own propaganda, basically. Do you really... If you really believe in the message, you don't need to be like a propagandist. You can just tell the truth. But no, they're like, let's mimic what they've done on the right. But they do it in the most insular, stupid ways. This is not going to appeal to anybody. And it's hilarious that they pretend like it's all about facts and information. But then they say it's for the 65.8 million. So what? The only people who are supposed to care about facts and information are the 65.8 million? No, everybody's supposed to care about facts and information. So you're not trying to reach out of your bubble. You're trying to stay within your bubble. And also the things that you're putting on Verrett are not, they're not facts and information. It's things that serve your own purpose and your own narrative. And by the way, there's been a lot made of the fact that 12% of people who voted for Bernie in the primary voted for Donald Trump. Guess what? Most of them were not Democrats prior to 2016. So you know what that means? Bernie Sanders got crossover voters from the right, and now Hillary Clinton supporters are smearing him for getting crossover voters from the right, which means they're smearing him for being a strong politician, because that's something that, you know, you win if you do that. So everybody says Bernie would have won in the general because all the polls showed him beating Trump, and he was able to get people who crossover voted from the right. So they don't tell you that. They don't give you that context. 12% of Bernie supporters voted for Donald Trump. They don't tell you that most of them were Republicans. So they take a strength of Bernie and they turn it into a weakness. And furthermore, there were more Hillary Clinton supporters who voted for McCain in 08. That's another piece of information they don't tell you. That if you're going to blame Bernie for Hillary losing, then you have to blame Hillary Clinton for sending voters to John McCain. Because more Hillary Clinton voters voted for John McCain than Bernie Sanders voters voted for Donald Trump. So they don't give you the facts. They don't give you the information that is counter to their narrative of Hillary's always a victim, Hillary's always right, it's always the, you know, they claim in this website that the mainstream media had a palpable anti-Hillary Clinton bias. There are literally leaks of Donna Brazile giving Hillary Clinton debate questions before the fucking debate. There are emails of Debbie Wasserman Schultz emailing MSNBC host saying, I will speak to your boss if you don't give us better coverage. That's the argument you're going to make? The media too hard on Hillary Clinton? Verrett is going to be the most, it's going to fail in an epic, hilarious way. Like, it will just utterly implode. Anybody who invested in it is an idiot. And you just wait and watch and see. Fucking Verrett. Nobody's going to use Verrett. Peter Dow, the clown of all clowns, was the operative force behind this. In an already oversaturated media environment, social media environment, they're going to throw out another platform that isn't even intuitive on how to use it, and it's only for Hillary Clinton supporters who want to be in that insular bubble. Good luck with that. Okay. This article from The Hill is a great example of an establishment bias, and I want you to take note of the framing here. Sanders' single-payer bill poses dilemma for 2020 Dem hopefuls. That's weird. See, this, already we have a subtle establishment bias, because they're saying, oh, Medicare for all, it's a dilemma for 2020 Democratic hopefuls. So in other words, the accurate framing of that would be it's an opportunity for 2020 Dem hopefuls. If the Republicans had an issue that they had on their side that had over 60% support in the American people, would they say it's a dilemma? No, they'd say we have an opportunity. We have an issue that over 60% of Americans already agree with us on. We got to hammer away on this issue. So it's not a dilemma, it's an opportunity. But it's framed as a dilemma. Why? Because the establishment doesn't want Medicare for all. The Democrats are doing the bidding of the establishment and the corporations. So now it's a dilemma. Hey, do I serve my corporate donors and the establishment, or do I serve the people? It's a dilemma. It's hard to figure that one out. It's a dilemma. Okay, so let's see what they say here. Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan has become a key test for Democrats with 2020 presidential ambitions. Sanders, who energized liberals with his improbable run at the White House last year, is poised to introduce a long-awaited single-payer bill when Congress returns to Washington this month. The liberal icon insists it's not a litmus test for the Democrats, but he's actively seeking endorsements. Outside liberal groups are watching closely, with some hinging their own endorsements on a candidate's support for the health care model. Senator Kamala Harris, who's said to be eyeing a 2020 run, threw her weight behind Sanders' bill this week, highlighting the sense that potential candidates want to get on the right side of their base and do it early. The issue poses a dilemma for both Democratic leaders and presidential hopefuls who are walking a fine line between appeasing their liberal supporters without alienating the more conservative-leaning voters they'll need to win back power in the House, the Senate, and the White House. I'm going to come back to that portion in a minute because that's the most important part. Spokesmen for several Democrats with possible presidential ambitions, including Senator Amy Klobuchar, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, and Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, did not respond to a request for comment on their stance on single payer. Senators Chris Murphy, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Sherrod Brown, all potential White House contenders who have voiced support for single payer in the past, haven't said if they'll endorse Sanders' bill. Their offices were also silent this week. A spokeswoman for Senator Cory Booker, another possible candidate, referred to Booker's interview with Fox in April. He said then that, quote, I believe ultimately in ideas like single payer or Medicare for all, while adding that, quote, I don't know how we get it done in this environment. Sounds like somebody's hedging. They will face no lack of pressure to try, as liberal groups are already pushing for candidates to get on board. Okay, so Cory Booker, I mean, don't even get me started, man. Look at the way he phrased that. Such a politician. I believe ultimately in ideas like single payer or Medicare for all. What do you mean like? What are you saying? I believe like Medicare for all or single payer. Oh, so you mean like maybe a public option or maybe a Medicare buy-in. That's what like means. He didn't say, oh, yes, I believe in that. I like that. What do you mean like that? Why not just that? Well, like it. Okay, so a buy-in or public option, so watered down. So not the full progressive populist left idea that you should support. And then he says, I don't know how we get it done in this environment. In other words, don't hold me to what I'm saying here because we can't get it through anyway, so I'm not really in favor of it. That's what Debbie Wasserman Schultz said. Oh, if we had a clean slate, I'd support it, but we don't have a clean slate. So in other words, you don't support it. Oh, but if we get in the future at a time when maybe we can support it, then my support for the proper policy is contingent upon having enough people to get the proper policy. No, your support for the proper policy should be unwavering, steady. It should be no matter what, I support the right policy. Can you imagine that argument in a different context? Look, do I support ending segregation? Yes. But, I mean, look, I don't know how we get it through in this environment. people would say, what the no, do you support ending it or not? Your answer should be, yes, that's it. Yes, full stop. Yes, I support ending it. Well, you know, I support it, but I don't know how we get it through in this environment, and, you know, I support things like ending segregation. Here we go. Run around all day long. But, okay, the most important part, the issue poses a dilemma, they say, for both Democratic leaders and presidential hopefuls who are walking a fine line between appeasing their liberal supporters without alienating the more conservative-leaning voters they'll need to win back power in the White House. You see what they're saying there? So it's not just that you have Democrats who want to appease the establishment and the elites and their donors, because their donors don't want Medicare for all. The health insurance companies and Big Pharma doesn't want Medicare for all. But it's not just that the Democrats are appeasing their donors. It's that they've actually also drunk the Kool-Aid on issues like Medicare for all. In other words, they believe the right-wing framing. When the right wing says, government takeover, healthcare, too expensive, people don't want that, the Democrats go, no, no, they're totally right. People don't want that. And the establishment media here in the Hill, they say the same shit. They go, well, they need to try to, you know, appease the base. In other words, appease them. You got to appease them. In other words, just say what they want to fucking hear and then don't do it. That's what appease means. We're just going to appease them a little bit here. But they say, without alienating the more conservative-leaning voters. So their assumption is, I mean, come on, that's crazy pie-in-the-sky far-left shit, Medicare for all. People don't actually want that, and you got to get the right-wing voters, too, in order to win an election. So you got to not do Medicare for all in order to win. That's the argument they're making. Hey, idiots, the Democrats have not favored Medicare for all, and they keep fucking losing. Maybe they should try to favor it, and then maybe they'd win. So maybe your entire framework is wrong. Maybe your built-in assumptions are 100% wrong. And if anybody at the Hill did some fucking research before they wrote an article, they would learn very quickly that over 60% of the American people support Medicare for all, including over 80% of Democrats, and there are more Republicans that now support Medicare for all than don't support Medicare for all. There are more Republicans that support it than don't support it. So their assumptions are wrong, because they're so smug and arrogant in their corporatism and their establishment elitism that they just assume whatever the D.C. strategists say must be correct, and the strategists say we should never go left wing. People don't want a living wage, no, even though 80% of the American people do. People don't want to raise taxes on the wealthy, no, even though 58% of the American people do. People don't want free college, no, even though 60% of the American people do. People don't want Medicare for all, no, even though over 60% of the American people do. People don't want these left-wing ideas. They don't want to legalize marijuana. Don't be extreme now. That's the establishment left. Oh, yes. They do want it. Yes, they want it. 58%. One poll, over 60% of the American people want to legalize marijuana. You name the populist left idea, the American people want it, not just the left, but the center and even the right. People on the right, when they hear populist left ideas, they go, I like that. They don't know that it's populist left. They just go, I like Medicare. I like Medicare. So, okay, let's do that. They don't put that on the spectrum because people don't know enough about labels. So everything populist left, according to the polls, is overwhelmingly popular, but the idiots in the establishment media and the idiot establishment Democratic strategists are like, whatever you do, don't go populist left. But that's how the Democrats will win. So notice, it's all subtle, but every article on this is dripping with dead wrong establishment bias. Okay. Next. I got to try to squeeze in three more in 10 minutes. Big Pharma is out here looking out for the well-being of the American people again. New cancer drug priced at $475,000 raises questions about pricing and value. The $475,000 price tag is much less than Wall Street expected and might disappoint some investors who hope for a premium on such a complex drug. But it's still causing anxiety among patients. Mindful of the hit its reputation could take, Novartis is offering, in effect, a money-back guarantee. If a patient fails to respond in the first month, there will be no charge. Wow, how kind of them. It's not really straightforward to figure out what the price should be, said David Epstein, a former head of Novartis Pharmaceuticals, who now chairs a biotech called Rubius Therapeutics. Novartis chief executive Joe Jimenez is on record saying the company invested more than $1 billion to get to this point, which would include running clinical trials and outfitting production facilities, but the company has declined to provide any breakdowns. That's interesting. As it turns out, the drug was discovered with funding provided by the National Institute of Health to different institutions, including the University of Pennsylvania, which partnered with Novartis. In all, Mitchell and other activists calculate taxpayers provided $200 million to develop the CAR-T technology that is now being used by several companies to develop an array of drugs. The procedure is quite complex. Patient blood cells are extracted and then modified to attack cancer cells before being reinjected into a patient. Novartis also received a tax credit equal to half the cost of clinical trials, according to Jamie Love of Knowledge Ecology International, a consumer group that tracks access to medicine issues. Quote, when you propose a price like this, it's incumbent to have more transparency, he insisted. Okay, so let me give you the real breakdown of what happens here. Novartis is crying poverty. Oh, my God, we invested $1 billion to try to get this drug, and we're only going to charge $475,000 for the drug. How fucking kind you are. Wow, that's so sweet of you to only charge only $475,000. But then you dig deeper, they give no breakdown of where the $1 billion they spent is, number one. Number two, what's actually proven is the amount of money taxpayers have given them. $200 million, National Institutes of Health directly involved, University of Pennsylvania directly involved, on top of a giant tax credit that they got. No, spare me your absolute horseshit. This is nonsense. This is, yet again, for-profit corporations sucking off the teat of the American middle-class taxpayer, and then when they develop the technology funded by the fucking government, they turn around and say, we're only going to charge you $475,000 for this. Look, man, understand something. There are people who listen to this show who are significantly to the left of me, and they get mad at me that I'm not as far left as they are. I'm not against profit. You want to have profit in an area which should be dictated by market forces? By all means. You want to have profit for the video game that you make? Sure. The car you make? Sure. The couch or the bed, the consumer good, the sneaker, whatever it may be? Yes, by all means. Free market, make your profit, do whatever the fuck you want in that realm. There should be regulation, of course, but 100% right capitalism all day long. No problem with it whatsoever. Don't tell me that this shit is equal to that and that this needs to be treated in the same way economically as those other things I just mentioned, because that's just fucking stupid. We're going to have life and death decisions and the profit motive involved. We're going to have big pharma price gouge the shit out of us as they buy the government. We're going to have for-profit health insurance companies try to find ways. They have whole departments that are dedicated to trying to wiggle out of paying for claims for people who are sick and need their health care. Don't try to tell me that everything is the same and every industry should be capitalist and there should be no government. Oh, keep the government out of this. Don't get the government involved in this. Don't regulate this. Don't make this socialist. Don't make sure that doesn't have a profit motive. Go fuck yourself if you think like that, because that's just dead wrong. You're just wrong. This is exactly what government should be for. I want my tax dollars going to shit that makes sense. We spend over $100 billion a year to maintain 900 military bases. We spend money, $80 billion a year, for a subsidy, a corporate welfare check to the big banks. And you're going to tell me that when somebody gets sick and they need help, a pharmaceutical company, which we paid for the fucking research to develop the drug, they're going to charge that poor person $475,000 goddamn dollars? Please. And then also, remember, we're not allowed. The government passed a rule, we're not allowed to negotiate with Big Pharma. So for Medicare drugs, for any drugs, you know what happens? The pharmaceutical company says, oh, you owe us X, whatever that number is, and the government has to pay it.
Okay.
In Canada, they pay 20%, 25%, half in some cases, for their drugs as we pay for ours. Because they fucking negotiate with the companies. We don't even negotiate with them. Pharmaceutical companies bought and own the government, and that's why they get away with shit like this. So we pay for the research and development. We develop the technology. The company turns around and says, you should thank us. We're only going to charge you $475,000. If you think the system doesn't need reform, you're a fucking moron. Okay. Take a look at this absolute horror unfolding in Myanmar right now. Burma, Rohingya children beheaded and burned alive as refugees continue to flood into Bangladesh to escape violence. Rohingya children have been beheaded and civilians burned alive, according to witness testimony and claims that Burma's military and paramilitary forces are committing genocide or a pogrom against the Muslim minority in the country's western Rakhine state. Around 60,000 refugees are believed to have fled over the country's western border into Bangladesh in just a week following a clampdown on Rohingya militants. Civilians who escaped gave horrific accounts of violence and destruction by Burmese soldiers and other armed groups. A man named Abdul Rahman, 41, said he had survived a five-hour attack on Chut Pien village. He told Fortify Rights, a charity working in the area, that a group of Rohingya men had been rounded up and detained in a bamboo hut, which was then set on fire. My brother was killed. Burmese soldiers burned him with the group. We found my other family members in the fields. They had marks on their bodies from bullets, and some had cuts. My two nephews, their heads were cut off. One was 6 years old, and the other was 9 years old. My sister-in-law was shot with a gun. Wow. That's unbelievable. And the leader of Myanmar is a Nobel Prize winner. Come on, man. I mean, what else do you call this but a genocide? I don't know what else to call it. I mean, that is exactly what it is. You have to have the UN put pressure on Myanmar. I mean, again, you want to talk about an instance where you should immediately cut off all trade with them? Cut off trade with them. Basically do effectively a BDS-style system, but get international cooperation and force their hand to stop committing a genocide, maybe. And this is an instance where even if the UN were to get involved and have people with guns just defend the Rohingya, set up a perimeter and defend them, you know, that would be preferable. I doubt that the soldiers in Myanmar are going to fire on UN peacekeepers. Now, that's not a perfect solution, but what other solution is there? What's funny is the people who are hawks in the U.S., the neocons, nobody's bringing this up, right? Nobody says, oh, we need unilateral U.S. military action. Unilateral U.S. military action to prevent the genocide. Nobody's bringing that up. Weird, it's almost like that's only brought up when a country is 100% an enemy of ours. But if we're, you know, if we have a neutral relationship with them or if we have a good relationship with them, oh, we'll turn a blind eye as they commit atrocities left and right. Well, that's exactly what's happening. So any question you had remaining in your mind, which would be amazing if you had any at this late date, as to whether or not the U.S. cares about human rights and altruism and justice, please. I present it here. I rest my case. This is one story. Genocide going on. Nobody, none of the neocons are like, well, we need to do military action right now to stop it. None of them say that. None. Zero. Now, again, I'm not saying we should do that. I'm not saying we should militarily and unilaterally do anything. I'm saying immediate economic sanctions to crack down and force Myanmar's hand to do something to stop this. And then perhaps you have an international response. See, that's I don't like unilateral U.S. military force. But if you're talking about the world collectively, the United Nations collectively, preventing some sort of genocide? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, even if it's just protection. The peacekeepers there to stop any further atrocities from happening. 100% fine with that. And fine with that not just in this instance, fine with that in other instances too, where it's clear that there's some sort of a genocide going on. Remember when it was the ISIS and the Yazidis? And the Yazidis were on a mountaintop with no food, surrounded by ISIS, and they were going to fucking slaughter them? Yeah, if you had not unilateral, but an international gathering to protect the people, totally fine in that situation too. So my standard has always been unilateral just for self-defense. Hey, there's an imminent threat of attack against us, self-defense. But to stop a genocide, yes, you could have the international community come together to do something to stop that. I've never seen a clearer case of it here. But there seems to be very little outrage over this. Okay. All right, final story of the day, even though I'm over time. BBC News has some uplifting new facts for secular people. And as you would imagine, I'm pretty happy about this because the name of the show is Secular Talk, so I'm quite secular. Here's what they say. For the first time, more than half of people in the UK do not identify as religious, a survey suggests. Last year, 53% of people described themselves as having no religion in a survey of 2,942 adults by the National Center for Social Research. Among those aged 18 and 25, this is a whopping number. The proportion was higher at 71%. The Bishop of Liverpool said God and the church remains relevant. Yeah, okay. And that saying no religion was not the same as considered atheism. The figures shown to BBC Radio 5 Live reveal a downward trend for religious belief in the UK. When the National Centre's British Social Attitude Survey began in 1983, 31% of respondents said they had no religion. So it's a clear uptick of irreligiosity in the UK. This is something you're seeing similar trends in other industrialized countries. You do not see that same trend if it's not an industrialized country. In other countries, religiosity is the same or even increasing in some instances. It's in industrialized nations where you see the decrease. I don't know why that is. There's probably many theories out there as to why that is. I think one of the things would be the abundance of things to keep you entertained and keep your interest piqued in industrialized societies where, you know, you have the internet, you have movies, you have TV, you have this available free flow of information. It's easier to debunk shit when you have a free flow of information. But it's also that you have a lot more hobbies. And going to church or going to temple or going to some mosque or some religious gathering seems just like a pain in the ass and boring, to be quite honest. But this is obviously, I think, a positive trend. But that number, 18 to 25-year-olds, 71% of 18 to 25-year-olds, dude, TikTok, there's a direct correlation between industrialized societies and irreligiosity, and that's not a bad thing, you know? Contrary to what many people believe, many in the older generation believe, just because somebody's not religious doesn't mean, like, when older people hear that, oftentimes they think, oh, that means they don't believe in right and wrong. They don't believe in morals and ethics, because how can you believe in it if you don't think there's an ultimate daddy figure in the sky, a wizard who's grading your actions? No, actions can be good or bad or moral or immoral on their own. You don't need a cosmic judge in order to make an action bad or good. You can evaluate it based on the relative effects it has on this earth. If you're bringing misery to people, if you're physically hurting somebody, yes, that would be an immoral act. That would be you violating somebody's rights. And, you know, the idea of treating others as you would like to be treated, that doesn't need to be tied to religion in order to be relevant and be accurate, you know? So it's not true. There are polls that show people think, there are many people who think if somebody says, oh, I'm not religious, that they're saying, oh, I don't believe in right and wrong. That's not true. In fact, if you poll people who aren't religious, what's funny is they tend to have a philosophy of morality and ethics that more coincides with the character Jesus than Christians' philosophy coincides with Jesus. So isn't that funny? You have more Christ-like atheists than you have Christ-like Christians. Wow. So this is nice. I think we covered a story like this recently where I think it was 51% of people were irreligious, but now it kicked up to 53%. And it is true that no religion is not the same as atheism. No religion just means I don't believe in a particular religion. You could still be agnostic. You could still be some sort of vague deist who believes in a god, but not a god of any particular theology. So, but either way, no religion is much closer to atheism than it is to theism, which is this idea of a god that can read your thoughts, and it's a god of a particular religion, and it's honestly the silliest idea of all of them. Okay. Out of time, guys. I love you. Kyle and Corin tomorrow. Back on Thursday. You know the deal. Much love. We are out.